Okay.
At this time, the chairperson should briefly qualify. Requirements for chairing a meeting at the Central Orlando Group. Saturday night speakers meeting are 1 year of continuous sobriety. To Central as your home group and to attend a group conscience meeting. Again, I am Heidi, alcoholic. My sobriety date is March 18th, 1987, and I am a home group member here at Central. I've also attended several of our group conscience meetings. And I like to say this whenever I chair as a member here of Central Orlando Group. If you are a member, I encourage you to come to our group conscience meetings to see the wonderful, talented, dedicated people who serve this group and have done for oftentimes many years. It is really something to see. We like to make jokes because it can give you a gray hair or two. However, it's worth it. And I've seen a lot of home groups, and this one is full of truly dedicated people. So you should come and check it out. I drank until I didn't want to drink anymore, and I couldn't stop on my own. And the consequences I was experiencing, jails, institutions, degradation, humiliation, I had lost everything. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, you offered a way out and made some simple suggestions about taking some simple actions a day at a time. And my life has changed dramatically. The restoration of my dignity has been a part of my sobriety. And I can't thank you enough. I'm about to celebrate 25 years of sobriety. I'm over 50 years old, and I believe that this is the best time of my life. So those of you who are new, keep coming back. Dream big. And be prepared to be surprised at how much better it turns out to be than your tawdry little dreams. So, that's enough out of me. The group has asked, I did read your mind, Gordon. The group asked me to remind you to please make sure your phones are off and to refrain from moving around or talking while the speaker is sharing. The speaker that I've asked to join us this evening is Larry. I got to know Larry a little bit during our noon meetings here at Central. Again, for those of you who are new, we have meetings at 6:30, 10, noon, 6 p.m., 8 p.m. every day. So we're hoping that you'll join us here. I got to see him at meetings, and I was listening to him talk, and when I first noticed him in the meeting, I thought, oh, dude looks like an old hippie. And he's brilliant. He started to talk, and I was amazed at his knowledge about the steps and the book and how to integrate that into daily living. And I was very impressed. I feel like I learned from him. I'm inspired by him. And I'm hoping that you will give him your attention. Again, Larry.
Hi everybody, my name is Larry, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
Thanks Heidi for taking the meeting. Well, here we are. I guess maybe I should get a gold star for being willing to go to any lengths to stay sober. I took the night off work and drove down from Jacksonville to be with you all tonight. So that sounds like a big sacrifice, but really I'd rather be here with you all than anything else I can think of right now. I love this place. I love Central. As Heidi said, you know, I go to the noon meeting whenever I'm in town. And I've been fortunate to be sober for a pretty long time, and I've traveled a lot, lived different places, been to a lot of meetings, and there's definitely something special going on here in the recovery community that's in Orlando, and especially here at Central. So I'm really glad to be, you know, whatever little part of that I am. My job is to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, and to try to keep it to about 45 minutes if I can. I don't like to talk too much about the drinking part and all that stuff because we all kind of know what that's like, but I feel it's necessary to qualify a little bit before I go on. I grew up in an alcoholic home, and some of these things, you know, I tried to figure out for a long time why I was alcoholic, and I found that it really doesn't matter. But it's still part of my story, you know, how I got to AA. Maybe somebody will at least identify with some of the experiences I had and realized that this program might offer you some hope, just like it did for me. But I grew up in an alcoholic home, although my early childhood seemed pretty good. You know, my first 10 years, I have a lot of good memories. Spent time with my dad, going to ball games and picnics with the family and vacations at the beach and that kind of stuff. But sometime around when I was 10 or 11 years old, my parents' drinking got a lot worse and they started fighting in the home. And I went from being a pretty happy kid to a really unhappy kid. It seemed like pretty fast, you know, that happened for me. And, you know, I became obsessed really with how to get out of my house, you know, how to get away from my family. Thought about running away from home. When I was 11, a girl lived a couple doors over from us who was 14 years old committed suicide. She had a very troubled life, and I started thinking about suicide, you know, that maybe that might be something that would help me get out of this pain that I was in. And I didn't really have anybody to talk to, you know, because my house was crazy all the time, and I knew something wasn't right. So I came up with this great plan. You know, it was very carefully thought out that as soon as I became a teenager, when I turned 13, I was going to get drunk. Because I'd seen that the magic elixir worked for my parents. And for some reason, I had in my head that, you know, when I was 12, I was still a kid, so it wasn't okay to drink alcohol, you know, when you were a kid. But when I became a teenager, it was okay to experiment with alcohol. So my next-door neighbor and I, about a week after I turned 13, came up with this plan, and we each stole as much liquor as we could from our parents' liquor cabinets and came up with this concoction of gin, vermouth, and vodka, and scotch all mixed together to get enough to fill up a glass. And it was one of those, you know, pass the teeth, pass the gums, look out stomach, here it comes, and drank it down. And I knew within minutes that that's what I've been looking for. You know, I felt that hot rush, and suddenly everything was okay. And, you know, it's funny, you know, I'm sure a lot of you have been to speaker meetings. It seems like the speaker almost always talks about the first drunk, you know, and it's like if you ask a social drinker about the first time they drink, a lot of times they can't even remember. But for alcoholics, if you're not sure, if you can remember the first time you drank and it was a special occasion of some sort, it's probably not a very good sign in itself. But, you know, it seems like for us that, you know, whether it was really good or really terrible or both, it was a memorable occasion, you know, and it was kind of it's kind of that way for me. It was a little bit of both. But I knew from that point on that I wanted to do that as often as I could. And, you know, as a 13-year-old kid, I really didn't, you know, I didn't even have a clue about life yet. So fortunately, you know, it's when you're in seventh grade, it's pretty hard to have a regular supply of alcohol and also occasions to get drunk. So I didn't drink every day, but I would have if I could have. But I got drunk every chance I could get. You know, not everybody drinks this way, but I was pretty alcoholic right from the start. And, you know, even early on, I drank in really inappropriate situations, like getting drunk at school and got in trouble and all that kind of stuff. And a lot of it was just written off to, you know, teenage shenanigans and that kind of thing. Nobody ever really checked in with me to see how I was doing or whatever, you know, we do nowadays. This was a while ago, so, you know, I was just kind of left on my own. But my life, when I look back on it, was characterized a lot by having really good situations, you know, bright promise, turn around into really bad things happening. You know, sometimes through my own doing, sometimes maybe through fate. But it's kind of shown me over and over again, before AA and even well into AA, that I often don't know the good news from the bad news. You know, I'm really a bad predictor of the future, and a lot of the things that I thought were the best thing that could possibly happen have turned out to be bad, and vice versa. And I had my first real strong lesson of that when I was a sophomore in high school. My drinking, and I'd started using drugs by then too, had progressed. And I entered a scholastic competition, and I grew up in the D.C. area, and it was sponsored by NIH and Navy Med, and it was a science competition. And it was very prestigious, and I ended up being one of the finalists. I was top five out of this the whole metro area. And the prize was that you won a fellowship to work either at Navy Med or NIH. It was for people that were thinking of going into the medical profession, which I was at the time. And, you know, there was a write-up in my school newspaper and all this hoo-ha around it. And plus, it was a paid fellowship for the whole summer. That was the part I liked, you know, is that I was going to get, you know, have a job and get paid. But I had no idea until I showed up the first day for this gig that I was introduced to my mentor, and he was the head anesthesiologist in the experimental surgery department of Navy Med.
Oh,
and it was a little more than I had bargained for. You know, and this is back during the Vietnam War. They were doing a lot of experiments on baboons and chimps, simulating combat trauma and trying to come up with new triage techniques to save soldiers' lives. So anyway, I was a 16-year-old kid, and I walked into this thing, and they're basically sacrificing all these animals. It was a horror show. But the point of that was how unprepared I was to deal with something like that. And I made friends with a lot of the midshipmen there early on. They were guys really just a few years older than me. And I became sort of like their mascot because I had weed. You know, I had pot. And that was the one thing they couldn't get. But they did have access to all the best drugs in the world because it was the Navy experimental surgery. So we kind of traded off. I would bring them pot, and they introduced me to narcotics and sedatives and really strong hallucinogens and all this kind of stuff. Anyway, so to make a long story short, I didn't survive that summer internship. About a few weeks before it was to be over, I just snapped, and I took an overdose of PCP and ended up unconscious in the hospital for a few days. It was kind of a failed suicide attempt. And, you know, so that was, you know, this really great, you know, supposed to be this great opportunity for me. I managed to, you know, like it says in the book, I pulled the structure down on my head with a series of senseless sprees. And of course, I didn't know that was what was happening at the time, but when I became conscious, I found myself in lockdown in the psych ward, and I was introduced to the FBI because I had this controlled substance that nobody even knew what it was. And I was also introduced to AA at the ripe old age of 16. I didn't know why. You know, I was in the psych ward, but conveniently the AA ward was right where the psych ward was. Imagine that. So I went to some meetings and said whatever I needed to go to get out of there. But I was really devastated after that. You know, I was humiliated going back to my school, and I was fried. You know, whatever the effects of that were, I mean, it really, I wasn't sure that I was going to be able to read again. You know, it was a very bad experience. So I basically went from being a really good student to barely getting out of high school. I had become involved in performing music professionally a few years before that, which was really what I loved. I was trying to be a doctor to satisfy my parents or whatever. So when I got out of high school, I got a gig, perfect gig for a budding alcoholic drug addict. I got a gig touring with a fairly successful band traveling around the country. And, you know, that was perfect for me because we moved from town to town, so there was really no accountability. And if I thought that I already knew how to party, I was working with guys, you know, a fair number of years older than me that were seasoned veterans, not only at playing music, but at doing a lot of other things. So, you know, I was a pretty early achiever, you know, moving along the curve pretty fast. And I thought it was great. And really for the next 10 years of my life, from when I was 18 until I was 28, that's basically what I did. I traveled and I played music. And I thought that my job in life was to stay constantly buzzed and help as many other people do the same thing. You know, I was like reading toasts in bars and spearheading the movement off the cliff, you know, leading the charge off the cliff. So I didn't really have much accountability as far as, you know, keeping track of the consequences of what was happening with my drinking and drug use or any of this kind of stuff. But somewhere, I guess a couple years when I before I got to AA, I landed a gig in Daytona Beach, and it was once again one of these great opportunities. It was a gig at a beach bar, and not only was it a steady job that paid a lot of money, but we also, the band had an open tab at the bar every day, not just when we were working. And it was a kind of environment where people basically gave me drugs for free all the time. You know, people, whatever, you know, they wanted to see the band screwed up. And so I basically had an unlimited supply of women, drugs, alcohol, attention, everything, money, everything I thought that I wanted. I thought, this is it. Like Bill Wilson said, I had arrived. You know, this is what I wanted. And I survived a little bit over 2 years at that, you know, and it's kind of amazing that I lasted that long. But really what that whole experience did, and I look back, I'm grateful for it, but it basically pushed me to the bottom, like going off the cliff. You know, I might have been able to still pretend that I was controlling my life for a little while longer, but that experience with that gig in Daytona, and basically having no restraints at all on my habits, got me to the bottom that much faster. But once again, here's one of these things. I thought, oh, this opportunity of a lifetime. And the next thing I know, I'm crawling through the doors of AA, which wasn't really how I planned it. And I never knew, till maybe 9 months before I came to AA, the thought of quitting drinking or using drugs had never even entered my mind. You know, why would you do that? But I had this, I don't even know why it entered my mind, to tell you the truth. I guess I thought, you know, I was getting into my later 20s. I thought, well, 30 is coming up, and maybe I should think about growing up or something. But whatever it wasn't until I tried to limit my drinking in any way that I started getting an idea of how far gone I really was. And it scared the crap out of me, really. Because I always thought that I was drinking because I wanted to. But it was when I started trying to stop and I realized how difficult that was for me to do that I started to get an idea that there was a problem. And, you know, I started having some physical problems. I was 27 years old. My liver was distended. So I went to a doctor to find out what was going on. And, you know, he asked me, do you drink? And you already know what I told him, you know, oh, a little bit. And of course, I didn't go back to that doctor, that quack, you know, because he was trying to tell me some things that I didn't want to hear. But I knew in my gut, you know, that something was really wrong and was going to go even worse if I didn't do something. So I tried everything I could think of, and none of it, you know, it really made it worse, if anything. The more I tried to quit, the more just insane I felt. So, you know, I was thinking, I don't know how many of you all remember the movie City Slickers. It came out a while ago. Billy Crystal's in it. And, you know, there's a scene where he's with his two friends and they're playing Best Day, Worst Day. They're riding along on these horses. And, you know, the first guy asked Billy Crystal, you know, what was your best day or whatever? He goes, well, you know, going to a baseball game with my dad at Yankee Stadium. What was your worst day? My wife got diagnosed with cancer or whatever. And they asked the next guy, my best day is when I got married. You know, worst day, every day after that, or whatever it was. And so they asked the third guy, and he's like, what was your best day? No, I don't want to play. You know, I don't want to play. And they're like, oh, come on, man. You know, I don't want to play. So finally he says, all right, the best day of my life, my parents were fighting again because she caught my dad cheating again. The woman came to the house this time to pick him up, and they were fighting. And so I got in the middle, and I told him, look, you're not just cheating on your mother. You're cheating on us, too, on my sister and me. I want you to leave the house and never come back. And he went to hit me, and I stood up to him, and he left, and he never came back. And they go, going, that was your best day? I was like, what was your worst day? Same day. And I thought, for me, I remember still, it was March 17th, 1984. I was sitting on my patio behind House on Golf Drive in Daytona Beach trying to figure out, again, what the hell happened. You know, I made this great resolve that I was going to straighten up and pull myself up by my bootstraps and get out of that town. And I realized that I was in a blackout the night before and that, you know, I probably wasn't performing that well if I was in a blackout. And I went through the whole scenario of who could I blame. You know, it must have been the guys in my band or my boss or my girlfriend or my ex-girlfriend or her parents or my, you know, going through all this stuff. And it was almost like a voice came to me and said, Larry, you're an alcoholic. And it wasn't really what I wanted to hear, but it was the only thing that made sense. You know, suddenly all these crazy pieces of the puzzle fit together. And you know, when I look back, that was, I mean, the despair and the hopelessness that I felt, I've never felt before or since. And it seemed like the worst day of my life, but that was really the best day of my life. You know, because that was when things started to turn for me. You know, I looked on the outside like I'm in the bar, you know, leading the cheers and all this kind of stuff. And on the inside, that whole time, I was really just trying to cover up that pain because I was dying on the inside. So I made the calls. I went to AA. I went to my first meeting. And, you know, everybody's different. Some people get sent here by the court, dragging dragged in kicking and screaming and stuff. But for me, when I came here, I knew almost right away that I was in the right place, because people were, they were crazy like me. You know, I could tell they were talking the same kind of stuff. And they knew at least some of the pain that I experienced from drinking. So I was, you know, kind of relieved to get to AA and to find out that there were meetings every day that I could go to, because I was still working in this crazy bar every day, and I knew there was no way I was going to be able to not drink there if I didn't get some help every day. So I started going to meetings, and I had that gift of desperation where I was willing to do whatever they told me to do, and I started doing little bits of service work. I got to know people in AA, and you know, for me, I got sober in the 80s. For me, that was really a great time to get sober, because there were a lot of young people coming in that were around my age. And it was, I mean, it's kind of bizarre, but whatever stigma there was around alcoholism, it was almost cool at that time to get sober, because, you know, Betty Ford had opened her clinic, and, you know, these celebrities were getting sober, and, you know, I heard Eric Clapton on a speaker tape at a meeting, and I met Stevie Ray Vaughan at an AA meeting in Daytona. I thought, man, this is not so bad. You know, if this is AA, I can do this. So the fellowship really drew me in. I mean, I was all in as far as the fellowship goes. I went to as many meetings as I could, and it was great. And I was also fortunate I was still young enough that I cleared up. You know, my physical health came back pretty quickly, even with the liver problems and stomach problems and stuff. My physical health came back pretty quickly. I was still working, thank God. That was really the only thing I had, was my gig. But I had no idea how much money I was blowing until I quit drinking, you know, because I never even kept track of it. I had a place to live and food, but and drugs and alcohol, but I didn't, you know, once I quit drinking, I closed on a house when I picked up my six-month check. I was pissing away so much money. I couldn't believe it. So anyway, I mean, things on the outside got better really quick for me, but hey, this sobriety thing is okay. But one of the things, after I'd been in AA for a little while, maybe around a year and a half or so, my life kind of started to unravel a little bit, and I didn't really know why. But I started, I started getting in conflict with people. It started at work. I ended up firing my whole band. Well, whatever, that's a whole other story, but, you know, you're all fired, get out of here, you know. So I hired a new band, and but then I started getting in conflicts with more and more people, and I didn't know why, and really it was, I look back and I could see it's because I was running the show really hard. You know, I had surrendered my alcohol, my drinking, to whatever higher power, you know, I knew of at the time. I went through the motions of saying a prayer, asking God to keep me sober, and it worked. You know, the compulsion was lifted. But everything else, I was still running the show really hard. And I'd made a couple really brief efforts at going through the steps. I did one four-step. I spent an afternoon writing it. I did another one. I think I took a whole weekend writing a four-step and shared that stuff. And it got some of the really yucky stuff that was bugging me out of my system. But I had never really gone through the steps. I didn't even really know what was involved in that, because I was, don't drink, go to meetings, that was working for me. So from, say, a year and a half in AA to around the time I had 3 years, my life just, I didn't know what was going on, but it started unraveling, you know, and I became increasingly uncomfortable. I was getting restless, irritable, and discontent, even though I wasn't drinking. And on the eve of my third anniversary in AA, I felt like I did before I came into AA. I felt hopeless and desperate, because my life was like a battlefield. I was ready to fire my band again. I just fired them a year before and hired a new one. I was ready to fire the whole band again. I had gone through a series of sick relationships sober. You know, I was able to stay in one for maybe like 2 months and then move on to another one. And I was still in conflict with my family, a lot of my friends, even in AA. You know, people had been kind enough to allow me to be one of their trusted servants, and I managed to get involved in all this group politics. And, you know, even AA didn't feel like a real safe place to me at that time. So I felt like I had nowhere to go. And I was at that point of feeling suicidal again, because I didn't want to drink. I'd already gone all over town telling everybody how great AA was, you know, so just out of pride I wasn't going to drink, but I didn't know what else to do. So fortunately, there were some people in Daytona where I'd gotten sober that were friends of mine that had gotten involved in this thing called Big Book Step Study, which was going through the steps out of the Big Book. And I'd never really heard of that, but I'd kind of been watching these people for a while to see what happened. You know, it was kind of like an experiment. I didn't even know that the steps were in the Big Book. You know, I thought they were in the 12 and 12, you know, because it says 12 steps. I'd read the Big Book. I thought I was a pretty smart guy, but I had to have somebody show me. So anyway, I was desperate enough. One of these guys who was a good friend of mine, and I'd seen him change a lot through going through this, and even though I didn't really like it, you know, I'd been to a couple of the meetings, and it sounded crazy to me. You know, they were writing these long four steps and, you know, making all these amends. And I was like, well, maybe that's okay for you, but I don't think I'm, you know, that sick that I really need to do that. So I stuck around until I got sick enough, you know, that I was ready to do that. So I went to this guy, and I was really relieved that, you know, he didn't say I told you so, or, you know, oh, I knew you'd be back, or, you know, it says in the book, they grinned, which I didn't like so much. You know, there was none of that. You know, he said, Larry, I can tell you're in a lot of pain, and I know what that's like. You know, so he was willing to help me. And, you know, I always thought I was kind of special and all this stuff, and, you know, I had good AA credentials and stuff, so I wanted him to kind of fast-track me, just start me in the middle of the four-step somewhere and clear this stuff up and let's get on with it, you know. And he told me that well, that was okay, but he couldn't really do that because he was really nice about it. He said, that's not the way I did it. I just don't know, you know, I started at the beginning. That's the only way I know how to do it, and it's probably not going to hurt you to go through the steps again. You know, so I'm 3 years sober, you know, all this kind of stuff. So he had me go back to the beginning of the Big Book and started step one. And I went through and I studied those first 63 pages. That was the first thing that I did, looking at steps one and two. And I was really astonished because I'd already been, I don't know, I'd been over 1,000 AA meetings at that point in a few years. I was astonished at how little I knew about myself and how little I knew about this disease, even after going to that many meetings, because I was just hearing what I wanted to hear. And a lot of the things that I thought made me an alcoholic, I was still looking at the outside stuff. I thought, you know, blackouts, puking, the arguing and fighting and stuff is what made me an alcoholic. And I realized when I started reading the book that that's not really the symptoms of being a real alcoholic that they're talking about. If you take a normal drinker or a social drinker and give them enough alcohol, they're going to black out or they're going to puke. You know, that's not, I mean, the fact that I did that repeatedly, I kind of made a fine art out of puking, you know, finding innovative and unusual ways to, anyway, that's not a good sign. But the things that it talks about in the book, you know, are, it says that the problem centers in the mind, you know, of the alcoholic, and it means that that stuff is kind of invisible to the outside. And that's why a lot of times only another alcoholic can help an alcoholic recover, because we know what that stuff looks like, but it's hard to see just by looking at somebody on the outside. So as I went through and I studied the book, you know, it talks about symptoms in there, and the first one is the phenomenon of craving. And I knew that was one of the things I identified when I first came to AA pretty early on. When people talked about craving, I knew what that was right away. But the part that I missed, that it mentions in the doctor's opinion at least a couple times, maybe three times, is that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. And that was the part that I didn't know. I thought everybody has a bad day and craves alcohol every now and then. And that's because the alcoholic life was the only normal one to me. I didn't know that if I craved alcohol, the normal people, that never happened. It doesn't say it usually does. It says it never happens. So if you're wondering if you're an alcoholic and you've craved alcohol and you're hoping that maybe you're not an alcoholic, not a good sign right there. That's kind of a big test. You know, and the being restless, irritable, and discontent is another thing it talks about in the doctor's opinion. And that was something, you know, I thought was so normal because my whole life, unless I was buzzed, that's the way I felt. You know, that's the way I felt even in AA without doing the steps or without having a drink. I felt restless, irritable, and discontent. And then, you know, in chapter 3, it talks about the curious mental twist. It talks about a number of different ways, but they're trying to, you know, describe the type of thinking that precedes a relapse into drinking, because that's the crux of the problem. And, you know, of course, I always underestimated the physical part of this disease, but I didn't really understand. I thought, and I've heard a lot of people say this, I thought that if I didn't have a drink, I choose today whether I'm not going to drink. You know, I have a choice. You know, I'm going to drink or I'm not going to drink. And I don't think that's true today. You know, I don't think that I really have a choice. What is the choice? You know, am I going to die or pick up a drink? You know, that's not really a choice. You know, so the choice is whether I'm going to do the program or not, and then God restores me to sanity where I'm not even thinking about that's a choice. You know, because for an alcoholic, it's not. But as they describe that state of mind, to, I don't want to go through all the different descriptions of it, but to me it's kind of a form of selective amnesia where I can't bring with sufficient force the memory of the suffering of a week or a day ago a lot of times. And that's a permanent state of mind. You know, the alcoholic mind, that doesn't change no matter how long I'm sober. You know, the only thing that steps in is the grace of God to give me some other alternative to that. But that's why I don't think. That's why I think I still felt I could run the show, that I could manage my recovery or think my way out of this, till I saw that part of this disease, and the first step being powerless over alcohol, is that it's not just the physical part, but I'm never going to really be able to make the right choice left to my own devices. The day is going to come sooner or later when I'm not going to be able to make that choice, and that's what, you know, the hopelessness of this disease. But like Heidi said, you know, the beautiful thing about AA is that it gives us a way out. You know, and the way out is the 12 steps. You know, it's the next 11 steps that follow. As I went through those 63 pages, looking at the second step, you know, a lot of times I had this idea that I had to have an understanding of God or have some kind of spiritual experience to take the second step. And really all it says is, do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there's a power greater than myself? And I was willing. I didn't really know what the heck this power was. But I knew that there had to be something greater than me that could help me with this disease. And I kind of had to go on faith that a lot of people in the program, at least most of them, weren't lying to me, that that's what had kept them sober. So for me, it made it a lot easier to take the second step, say, okay, the insanity, it's not the crazy stuff that I did when I was drinking. It's the insanity that precedes picking up the drink again, going back to the drink even when I know what it's going to do to me, or maybe I can't remember what it just did to me. And so, you know, I got into the steps. I took the third step. And the third step is a big step, but my sponsor broke it down for me. At that point in time when I was going through the steps, for me, all the third step was agreeing, turning my will and my life over to God as I understood Him, was really just agreeing to go through the rest of the program. Because I didn't really know what God was. I don't know if I know what God is today, but at that time, I was pretty confused still, but I believed there was something, a power greater than myself, even if it was Alcoholics Anonymous. And so for me, when I took the third step, I said that prayer on page 63 with my sponsor, and the thing that made it different from when I had said the prayer before was that he had me bring a notebook and a pen, and as soon as I finished taking the third step, he had me start writing on my fourth step. I started making my list, because it says, our decision was a vital and crucial step, but it would have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a vigorous course of action. So he, to make sure that I didn't just take the third step and then go, oh, this feels so good, you know, and just stay with it for a year or two or whatever, he had me bring a notebook to make sure that I got into action, because that's how the third step was really going to work, is through following the steps that come after it. And so I got into, you know, fourth step. And it was not like any fourth step that I'd done before. It took me quite a bit of time. I followed the outline in the book. I could talk for hours about that alone, because to me, the way the fourth step is laid out, the way it's laid out in the big book, is brilliant. I don't know how they came up with it, but it's genius. It's kind of a trick in a way, if you haven't done it yet. It tricks you into looking at yourself, you know, the truth about yourself. But I made the list of people, principles, and institutions I was angry at. And I thought I was pretty much, you know, I was Mr. Happy-Go-Lucky leading the toasts at the bar. And I was really shocked just at the number of resentments I had to begin with. You know, hundreds, I hate to say. You know, I was really a pissed off guy and I didn't even know it. And I went through and I did the cause and effects, you know, what they did that made me angry and what it affected. And that was great, because I got to take everybody else's inventory. You know, it was the one time that my sponsor gave me permission to take everybody else's inventory. So I went through and I wrote down everything that they did and what, you know, it affected my self-esteem, ambition, security, pocketbook, pride, all those things. And that part was pretty easy because I was good at blaming other people. But then the next part that came was, you know, first I read through that stuff on page 66 about the nature of resentment and saw how it led to futility and unhappiness and how the world and its people really dominated me. And when I looked at that and saw it in my own life, it made me willing to look at my part, you know, which was where I had to turn it around and look at it. Those things on page 67, you know, sometimes I've heard it called the best kept secret in AA. Huh. You know, it's where I take my own inventory. And of course, somehow I read the book, I don't know how many times, but I never saw that part. But it's, you know, where had I been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and afraid? And you write that all down on paper. And I didn't really like what I saw, but that's the only way out for me. You know, it says, you know, that alcohol is only a symptom of our disease, that selfishness, self-centeredness is really the root of our trouble. And it's a selfishness that I didn't even know that I had till I got into doing this inventory. And I couldn't even really see it on my own. You know, I followed the outline in the book, but it was really through having a lot of help from my sponsor. And I prayed every time I wrote. You know, I asked my higher power to help me see the truth about myself. And I was surprised at how much stuff came out. So anyway, I went through the fear inventory. I did the sex conduct inventory pretty much the same way. And I was as thorough as I could be. I was, you know, once again, I was amazed because my higher power showed me what I needed to see. And I felt a lot of relief. You know, as I got into that fourth step, that kind of hopelessness and despair that I was feeling a few months earlier went away. You know, I felt like I was on the path. And I started having a spiritual experience. You know, for me it began, part of the deal when I was doing the fourth step and I was turning around and looking at my own part is that prayer on page 66 where, you know, it says, God, I realize that so-and-so, fill in the blank, is spiritually sick like myself. Help me show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience I would grant a sick friend. God, save me from being angry. How can I be helpful? And I said that prayer for everybody on my list. And I didn't want to do it a lot of times. I still was angry towards them. I didn't believe that it would work. But I did it over and over again. And it started to change me. You know, it started to lessen the resentment. But it also started, that's when having some kind of personal contact with a higher power began for me. And, you know, I believe when it says, you know, we can only find God deep within ourselves, that in the final analysis, that's only where He could be found. And I didn't believe that because I thought inside there was nothing but shit. You know, I felt like I was, you know, a really bad person and that nobody would love me. And there certainly wasn't God inside here. But it was through that fourth step and looking in here and clearing out that stuff that had been blocking me off that I found out, yes, there was something of the higher power inside of me, just like in everybody else. It sounds kind of far-fetched, but I'm telling you, you know, that's what happened. And I've been skeptical ever since, waiting to see, you know, if the other shoe is going to drop and it's all going to go away and that kind of stuff. It's been a long time and it hasn't happened yet. I mean, I went through the steps, I hesitate to even say, 25 years ago, and it hasn't happened yet. So anyway, I went through, I shared all this stuff with my sponsor in the fifth step. I did 6 and 7, asked God to remove it, which was another surrender for me because I realized that I couldn't make this selfishness go away on my own. I had to have the help of my higher power. And I went out and I started making amends. And I had a lot of amends to make. That was really where the rubber hit the road for me when I had to go out and make face-to-face contact with people. I owed a lot of people money. I did a lot of slimy things. I did some of this sober. You know, that was really hard, you know, having to make amends for stuff I did my first few years in AA because I couldn't blame it on the alcohol. I couldn't really blame it on the alcohol before, but it was convenient sometimes. So, whatever. I was drunk. So as I started making amends, you know, my life really started to change. And, you know, I don't have enough time to tell you about all the stuff that happened, but, you know, I went from being in conflict in every area of my life to, you know, things starting to change. You know, my career starting to go forward. A lot of stuff that I thought was, you know, everybody else's fault, I found out that I was really my own worst enemy and standing in the way of moving ahead with my life. You know, what it's like now. One of the things that was really a relief to me, you know, once I got through the first 9 steps, is my sponsor told me that really all I have to worry about is doing 10, 11, and 12 the rest of my life. And I really like that because it's very simple. You know, all I've really got to worry about is 3 steps, because they kind of contain all the other earlier steps within them. And I like it because it's simple. You know, even with the built-in forgetter, I can still almost remember most of that stuff a lot of the time. But if I'm taking my own inventory and looking where I'm at fault and admitting where I'm wrong and going to higher power for some kind of guidance and then thinking about how I can help other people, I don't seem to have a lot of problems, you know. Or if I do have problems, they're not so bad, you know, even when it's pretty big stuff. And you know, I've been sober for a while, so I've been through a lot of things. I've buried both my parents. You know, I got married. I had a kid. Went through divorce. You know, had a lot of career ups and downs. But the whole time, I've been trying to practice 10, 11, and 12 as best I could. And I could say not once during that time have I wanted to drink. You know, if when it comes down, you know, the final analysis, I haven't wanted to drink. I haven't wanted to kill myself. I haven't wanted to kill anybody else. You know, it's been pretty good. But even though 10, 11, and 12, it's very simple, anybody who's tried it knows that it's not easy. You know, it's a full-time job just doing those three steps. And, you know, especially in step 12 where it says, you know, practice these principles in all our affairs, there's a lot of principles in AA. You know, what are these principles? Do they still have the little plaque? It's somewhere around here.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And those are really great principles, but even that's, I really like the slogan, keep it simple. Even that's almost like too much for me to remember. So, you know, I just break it down. You know, the principles that I need to practice are 10, 11, and 12. You know, the steps are principles. They're rules or codes of conduct. And once again, it's easier said than done. You know, to try to... It's easy in AA to practice 10, 11, and 12. Relatively easy. But to try to do that with my family members, in my business life, in my sex life, or in my relationships... You know, because sometimes I think that there, you know, it's business. There's different rules that apply there. You know, this is, you know, my love relationship. There's different rules that apply there. And when I start thinking that way, I just feel uncomfortable. You know, I start getting uncomfortable in my own skin. It's a lot easier if I just do what it says to do. You know, when I think about my life today, you know, fast forward, it's hard for me to even believe, you know, what's going on. At this stage, I've got all the material stuff I ever wanted and more, you know, and that's really not even the best part. But I've been able to work in the field doing what I love. You know, I still am involved playing music, and I get paid a pretty decent, you know, living to do that. And at this point, I can even kind of choose when and how much I want to work and where I want to work and stuff. That really means more to me than the material stuff, having that kind of freedom. But that never would have happened, certainly if I was drinking, and I don't think it would have even happened if I was still the same guy I was 20 years ago in AA, because I was still an asshole at times. You know, being sober was not... If I didn't get my way, I'd, you know, manipulate, do whatever I had to do. So a lot of it's AA. You know, it's because I try to, with my work, I try to put it on a service plane and think, how can I help people? You know, instead of what am I going to get out of it, I try to think, what do I have to offer? And it's like if I stop worrying about that stuff, then everything else seems to come to me, you know. But if I start thinking about it, it kind of messes it up. It's hard to explain. But I have this freedom, you know, that I always wanted, but I could never get by trying on my own power or trying to use self-seeking to get it. It's by surrendering to AA and my higher power that then I'm free to do whatever I want. It's I guess another one of those paradoxes. But there's so many blessings of this program. I'm going to be 56 years old in a couple days, and I don't know what a 56 year old guy is supposed to feel like, but I feel pretty damn good, you know. I was out. I hiked 450 miles in October on the AT, and all I can think about is how can I get out there again and do it some more, you know. And I know for sure that I wouldn't feel like that if I wasn't sober, you know. And but even all that stuff, you know, having now that I've kind of got all the material stuff that I ever wanted and more and all that kind of stuff, what I really realize is that people are the most important thing to me. And I always wanted that sense of connection, you know, that I never got with my family, I could never really find. And I found that in AA. You know, I found my people here in AA that I still haven't really found it anywhere else. I do have some great friends outside of the program, but, you know, my family, sadly, the ones who are still living are not in recovery, and it's just not a good scene. I can't really hang out with them very long. And, you know, even my own family, my ex-wife and my daughter, my ex-wife was sober for a few years in AA, but she went out 20 years ago and is still drinking. So, you know, those people I can't really be around too much. But the trade-off that I've found through the friends that I've made in AA, there's a number of people that I got sober with 20-some years ago that I'm still friends with. You know, they're still sober, and they're like brothers to me. They're the best friends that I've ever made, even though we're kind of scattered around the country. And, you know, that's the kind of blessings that I've gotten from AA that I think I value more than anything. You know, and even being able to come, you know, I've lived in a number of different towns, including Orlando, a number of places in Florida and around the country, and it's great that I can go to a different place. I come to Orlando, and it feels like family here, even though I'm, you know, a few hours from home. Now, I don't know, you know, I thought that going to AA was, you know, like I said, it was the worst day of my life, but it's turned out to be the best thing. And you know, like Heidi said, you know, if you're new and you're coming here, whatever you think your wildest dreams are as far as, you know, what the best thing that could happen for you, if you stick around AA, don't limit yourself by, you know, whatever you can think. The sky's really the limit if you stay sober and make the effort to work this program. Thanks.
Thank you.